There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
The Grill, live from Barassi, where the game is always on. Or not, as the case may be at the moment, because there aren't many games on. Into the second hour of the show, I'm up here on the rooftop garden for this afternoon's show. We've got Mark Archer and Owen Shaw alongside me. If you'd like to come and join us, please do exactly that. Can't promise you a huge amount of live sport until much, much later on. However, there is the small fact of some rugby, A, to look forward to, but also to reflect on. We've just had a full-time, is that right?
We have had a full-time in Super Rugby. The Lions from Johannesburg have defeated the Sunwolves from Tokyo, 37 points to 24. Scored 5 tries to 3, so a good win on the road for the Lions. Wins earlier today for the Hurricanes in Wellington, and then the Waratahs had a win in Sydney. 2 matches kicking off in Super Rugby. Just in about 5-10 minutes time, we'll be in Pretoria, the Bulls will host the Chiefs from New Zealand, and then in Durban, the Sharks will take on the Melbourne Rebels. Plenty of rugby also in domestic stuff, action in the English Premiership, 4 matches, matches also in the Pro 14 and the Top 14 in France.
Let's just reflect on the Formula One Grand Prix, the start of the season. This time last week, we were getting ready. In fact, we knew who was in pole. We knew that Lewis Hamilton was on lead. We had a sort of bit of a chat, you, myself, and Chris McCarty, about the fact that nothing really had changed from the beginning of the previous season. However, it did change in the result itself. Not in the fact that the constructors continued to dominate in the form of Mercedes, but we were expecting pillar to post for Lewis Hamilton. He had to put up with being the bridesmaid on this occasion, as Valtteri Bottas dominated the season opening Aussie Grand Prix after overtaking world champion teammate Lewis Hamilton. Is that a sign of things to come, Mark Archer?
Well, it's probably not a sign of things to come or a major change that Mercedes was 1-2. I guess the surprise was that Hamilton was not just second, but a distant second. He was way behind Valtteri Bottas. And he was also under, you know, look for much of the race, it looks like he might be under pressure for his second spot. But the two Mercedes cars were way faster. But the difference between Bottas and winning the race, he took the lead over Hamilton on the first bend, and then he never really looked back. It was I watched the start and the end of that race. Not much in the middle. I went off and did some work. But, the gap of distance between what you would thought would be two quite similar cars. At the start of the season, they've done the same amount of testing, same sort of engine, same sort of setups, two different drivers, and to have a massive gap between of distance between the cars was very surprising. The other big thing that was surprising to me, to see how far back behind the Ferraris were. Usually at the start of the season they're quite competitive, and we see them sort of jumble in matches. But they do say that the Australian Grand Prix is a slight anomaly in terms of it's a funny sort of setup of course. It's a road course. It's not like the usual configuration, and it's hard to get a real bearing on things. They go next week to Bahrain, which is a traditional motor racing circuit, so we may see a bit more sort of normality appear to the races, apart from Mercedes being at the front of the grid. And then we'll see how the rest of the other cars and constructors come together. But yeah, very impressive by Bottas. If Mercedes can't be pushed by Ferrari, it'd be nice to see some nice friendly rivalry within the Mercedes camp for the title. I'm not sure that will happen, but good win for the man from Finland.
Also this time last week, we were reflecting on the extraordinary careers of Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. Nadal had to pull out of that semi-final down in Miami because of the... in Indy Wells, because of injury. We can, though, however, this weekend, reflect on the extraordinary career of the current world number one, Novak Djokovic, returning to winning ways with a straight set victory over Bernard Tomic of Australia to reach the Miami Open third round. Serbia's Djokovic lost in the third round at Indian Wells last week, beat Tomic 7-6, 6-2. 31-year-old is aiming for a record 7th title in Miami and faces Argentina's Federico Del Bonis next. So Djokovic continuing to dominate elsewhere in this tournament over in Miami. Dominic Thiem, who beat Roger Federer to win Indian Wells on Sunday, missed out on the Sunshine Slam, losing 6-4, 6-4 to Hubert Hukarz of Poland, who had a good run here in Dubai earlier on this year. It's fascinating tennis at the moment, isn't it? Because these The top three boys are picking and selecting their tournaments so carefully at the moment to manage their schedules and their respective injuries as well. It sort of opens up all these draws around the world on the ATP Tour.
Yeah, you did right. And we saw your good friend Dominic Thiem beat Roger last weekend, but he won the big event at Palm Springs. So you get the odd week when the different players are picking and choosing schedules and playing different surfaces that suit them or gearing up their own games towards one of the Grand Slams. You can see it does create some opportunities for young guys. Obviously, Andy Murray's been struggling with that injury, so he's kind of out of the picture. With the big three other guys picking and choosing, it does give other, particularly in the male side of things, a chance to really get some points up and win some big events and sort of start stating their name. We've seen a little bit with some of the guys there. Zverev has done well and taken advantage and won some tournaments. Dominic Thiem has been much talked about as a player who could win a Grand Slam in the future, particularly on clay. He's particularly strong. So it is a good opportunity for some of the younger guys, some of the lesser lights, to really sort of push through now and get some victories and get some confidence and really challenge, because they can't go on forever, can they?
Exactly that. Exactly.
It's got to end sometime.
We will reflect on that one. We're also going to reflect on the future of a certain Jose Mourinho. He's been back on our screens here in the region, special guest for beIN Sports in the last couple of days for the European qualifiers for 2020. He's been dropping some rather large hints as well, saying I'd like to be back in the summer in June for a new club and a new pre-season. I know exactly what I want, what I don't want. I know what I want in terms of not the specific club, but the nature of the job, the dimension of the job as well. The former Porto, Chelsea and Inter boss says he misses nothing at all, but is not on holiday or bored with nothing to do. I am working, preparing myself for the next one, he added whilst in conversation in studio here in the region. So, Jose Mourinho, where next for he? Let's get the thoughts of the boys. Mark Archer and Owe Shah, both with us at the moment. Club or country?
I was just thinking about Mourinho, and he has been spending a lot of time in the region, which may lead me to believe he might be going to somewhere, maybe France. He hasn't coached there before. Paris maybe might be a destination for him. I'm trying to think of where he hasn't been or where he'd be welcomed back to. I can't see him emerging back in the Premier League in a hurry. I don't think he would want to. If he did go back there, he'd want to go to a top contending club. I don't think any of the top clubs will take Mourinho at this stage. So he's not going to go to, you know, somewhere in the middle there, is he?
Yeah.
He's not going to end up at West Ham or Fulham or Crystal Palace. You can't see him, you know, anywhere there. So, and we talked about for a little while, maybe Real Madrid might be where he might go back to, but that's not going to happen.
Not now.
Because the big man's gone back there, Zinedine Zidane. So where may he go? Italy, maybe? Or maybe France?
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, he likes the top jobs, doesn't he? He doesn't mess around at the bottom of the barrel. I mean, but all the top jobs, like you said, the Real Madrid one, now Zidane is, you know, obviously he's taking care of that nicely. I can't see him getting a top job right now for a little while, because
I wonder if his star's waned a little bit, you know, because we've seen a lot of younger managers per se with brighter and more vibrant ideas of coaching coming in, and whether he doesn't really have that liberty to be picky these days.
Could be an end of an era. I reckon.
The place where, I mean, obviously he has ambition still to stay in Europe, but you wouldn't be surprised if he ends up signing a deal in China, would you? Or somewhere, maybe Major League Soccer at some stage, or maybe that's not quite there yet. But these guys go to some of these sort of more clubs, like, you know, in China for a season or two. But he's not short of a bob or two, is he, Jose Mourinho?
I was just going to say, that's going to be more financial, but he's not struggling. That's the thing. He always goes for those jobs that are, you know, they're the top jobs. I don't know. I really don't see him going anywhere at the moment.
I think it will be a club. I think you're right. There's been a lot of chat about him going to manage a country ahead of Euro 2020, or of course, Qatar 2020, or the Euros as well. I mean, sorry, Euro 2020, and then the World Cup in 2022 as well.
It'd be funny though to see him. I don't know if he's set up to be a national coach.
I don't think he is.
If you did see it though, where you might see him and where it might make some sense is to go to somewhere like Portugal. You just, that kind of is a natural fit for him. Whether that's where he wants to go and that's what he wants to do, because you don't really get a with your national team, you're not really developing it. You're not really developing players, are you? Which is never his way. So he wants to take players, come in, they get short periods of time with them as a national coach, got to bring them together, get them unified, get them playing some sort of style that you can only do in a short space of time, and then go to tournaments. I'm not sure that's really what we're at.
Because I think he prefers that sort of daily challenge as well. That's why he likes being associated with clubs. Because at the same time, the man's got an ego, and I know he can be right old misery guts in press conferences, and when he's being pursued by journalists on pavements and asked for comments left, right, and centre. But that's what he thrives on at the same time, isn't it? He does love being centre of attention.
Yeah, of course he does. He loves all that. I don't know, he comes across like, sometimes he might be irritated about the fact that, how you mentioned about, journalists sort of pestering him a bit, but he loves all that. I think that's in him. He likes the limelight, and that's, you can just see in his character, even how he holds press conferences. Mm. It's not just a simple press conference. There's something attached to it. And it's just the character of the man, I guess. And I don't know, he's an interesting guy, isn't he? He's always in the news, I know that.
Isn't he just? Where is he off to? Do send us your thoughts. Text them through to us now on 4001. What are you doing at the moment? Well, I can tell you are listening to The Grill. We're broadcasting live from the rooftop garden down here at Barasti.
The Grill, live from Barasti, bringing you the biggest sports stories right now.
Listening to The Grill, broadcasting live from Barasti, where the game is always on. We're up here on the rooftop garden. I say we because I am the presence and the company of Mr. Mark Archer and Mr. Awiz Shah. And we will be talking more on the world of cricket with the start of IPL 2019 in just a little while. Conscious also that rugby fans, well catered for today, no shortage of games to look forward to, club games that is, and of course reflections from what was a fascinating Six Nations. Mark Archer.
Yeah, congratulations to Wales. They slipped under the radar, but then they end up with a Grand Slam and a Six Nations title. So Warren Gatland's done a magnificent job there in his final year as the Welsh coach. And of course, them down in the Principality were pretty chuffed last weekend, Tom. They were pretty happy with themselves. And
good as well, weren't they?
None more so than the Welsh captain, Alan Wynne-Jones. What a warrior he's been in his career. And he rightly came away with the Player of the Tournament Award. I think that was awarded this week. Let's have a quick listen to Alan Wynne-Jones talking after that victory against Ireland, a comprehensive victory against Ireland at Cardiff last weekend.
2019 Grand Slam champions. Sounds pretty good. How proud a Welshman are you right now?
Sorry?
How proud a Welshman are you right now?
I could be sitting in the stands right about now, to be honest with you. I'm just proud with a group of guys and the backroom staff. It's a bit of a milestone for a lot of the staff in particular. But, anything can happen when you work hard and you're a proud nation, and I think we showed that over the last 9 weeks.
How much does Warren Gatland make this group of players believe that nothing is impossible?
It filters down. He's the man at the top, and don't get me wrong, we've been under pressure, he's been under pressure, but he's always been unwavering and pretty unflappable, really. It's easy to say that now off the back of a win, but he's got a bit left on his contract, like I said the other day, but I'm sure we'll miss him when he's eventually gone.
14th win on the spin has landed you the slam. What will that do for self-belief in the Rugby World Cup year?
I think it's probably more than self-belief. I think there's character at times, and we're not going to shy away at times. We've been pretty unconvincing as well. So we'd like to think there's still more potential in us, but we're going to be well aware that we just put a big target on our backs as well.
That was Alan Wynne-Jones, the Welsh rugby captain, celebrating in the aftermath of their victory against Ireland last Saturday at the Principality Stadium in Cardiff. They had a massive ceremony, a massive gathering, ticker tape parade almost, with speeches and singing the day after the win down there. And Ross Moriarty, the Welsh number eight, had this to say the day after that Wales won the Six Nations Championship and the Grand Slam.
Yeah, it's been great. Obviously, it's great atmosphere. Everyone's really happy. Everyone's pleased. As you can see, everyone's got a smile on their faces, so it's good.
And a great turnout, all those fans out there to celebrate.
Yeah, there's a lot of people turned out. I wasn't expecting it, to be honest with you. It's great to see everyone come out today, and it's a great day.
It's first Grand Slam for you, a third for Warren Gatland. No other coach had ever done that before. What are the specialities of Warren Gatland? What's his secret?
I don't think anyone knows the secret, but obviously he's got a huge amount of experience. Done great with all the Lions tours he's been in. Let the squad be comfortable, and you know, we've all got on really well over the last year or so. And but even all the time I've been involved, it's just been building and building, and you know, obviously it's really clicked this season.
And what part do you think he's played on your game in particular?
It's tough because obviously I've been involved and there's been some really great players in my position, so I think he sort of lets you step up and obviously try and show what you're capable of, but it's he just makes you feel comfortable in the environment, so it's not stressful, you don't feel on eggshells, so it's nice in that sense. And obviously then you feel comfortable, you'll be able to speak to the other boys, and they teach you things and you take bits away from them, so yeah, it's good.
Yeah, very happy times down in Cardiff and in Wales last weekend. Lots of speculation and chat, though, regarding the coaching situation in the Six Nations teams. None more so about who will succeed England. A little bit disappointing, obviously, in the championship, but did find some good form. Will Greenwood, former England international, had this to say about whether Warren Gatland might be the man to replace Eddie Jones in the future.
Well, that takes us to after the World Cup then. I just glanced at a story earlier on this morning. In fact, I think I only...
Gatland for England. Is that what you're going to say?
Exactly.
I mean,
it's... should England be targeting him if Eddie Jones does go after the World Cup?
So, who are the best coaches in the world? Steve Hansen, Joe Smith, Warren Gatland, by and large. You'd say those are the three. That's excluding Eddie, because Eddie's sort of taking a back seat after this World Cup, and they're in a transitional phase to look for the next coach. Warren Gatland's won 3 Grand Slams, more than any other Six Nations coach in history. He's delivered it when the Welsh regional rugby has been a mire. So he's plucked players from clubs that have struggled to find them in a situation to compete for the Six Nations each year. He took them to a semi-final in 2011, they were great in 2015. They were great. South Africa just turned them over, but just is just enough. And he keeps getting better. He's got a great defensive coach in Sean Edwards that nearly... I mean, Ireland got a consolation try. 80 minutes on the clock, it was 25-0. So, why wouldn't you go for Gatland? I think it's an obvious play. I mean, he's talked about he'd never be welcomed back over the Severn Bridge. Well, he will go to the World Cup with Wales. He'll do what he can with Wales. He'll take some time out of the game. And then he'll take his next job. Not one Welsh fan ever. And normally, if you go from Arsenal to Tottenham, they'll never forgive you. If you go from United to Liverpool, that's it. We're not having you. You know, certain places, you just can't change clubs. The reality is, with what Gatland's done, I think they'd give him a hero's welcome. They wouldn't want England to beat Wales. But what Warren has done, I mean, I was going to say give him the keys to Wales, but whatever it is you can award him with, he really should get it. He's an extraordinary coach. He really is. And my admiration for him has grown from one as a player who played against his teams. It was a sort of spiky relationship. I was at Quinn's and Wasps, and so there was that sort of never the twain shall meet, to getting to know him, working on Sky and the Lions tours. The last 3 Lions tours, understanding how he ticks, watching him operate, and just thinking, what a brilliant, brilliant man to spend time with. He travels a lot around Wales supporting junior rugby. He helped my old man up at Rhyl Rugby Club, went for the opening up at Rhyl. Has a car, will travel, gets up there, does what he needs to do, and then gets out on a park. And I tell you, he could go back here and pick up 15 people who've never touched a rugby ball in Sky, and within 2 days we'd have a crack military outfit ready to win the Six Nations. He's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. So if the job's available and he's available, bring on Warren.
Warren for England, is that an equation that you agree with? Do send us your thoughts on that one, 4001. So Wales, Grand Slam winners 2019, genuine World Cup 2019 contenders?
I think you've got to put them in the mix now. I thought before the Six Nations kicked off, I thought Wales were the third best team in Europe, and they've proved me wrong. What went in their favour this year, Tom, was they had their 2 biggest home matches against Ireland and against England. That's not to demean what they did in terms of success. They're going to have to take that form and go away to Japan and play on neutral things, and can they replicate the atmosphere within what was a very tough place to go in Cardiff? That's the big question. But they were lucky they got the two hardest games on paper, Ireland and England, at home. But they did what they had to do. They were comprehensive winners against both teams in the end. England was very tight, but they blew Ireland off the park last weekend. And not many of Joe Schmidt's teams get blown away like they do there. So it's really fine lines between those three teams in the Northern Hemisphere. I'd expect two of the three teams to go a long way in the World Cup, and one of those teams should be in the final, all things being equal.
Interesting, though, isn't it? Because we talked a lot about England's bench and their sort of strength and depth. The same could be said to a certain degree for Wales. They had a few injury concerns coming into this tournament. No Toby Faletau.
No Lee Halfpenny, really.
No Lee Halfpenny. Liam Williams was injured for a couple of the games as well. But they seem to be able to tap into a great wealth of talent to fill those spots at the moment. And certainly the back row was one of the standout back rows throughout the entire tournament. Josh Navidi, I think, is an absolute machine.
And defensively, and you think also Sam Warburton's just retired, who's kind of in his prime as well. And defensively, they were unbelievable. I mean, again, that Will Greenwood just alluded to it. With 80 minutes up on the clock, they led Ireland 25-0. They blanked them, and they got a consolation try at the end. You know, great. But Sean Edwards, the former rugby league star, has done a wonderful job with their defence. They just look so organised and so compact, and Warren Gatland's got them playing in that. They've just got enough. I think they're limited offensively. I think if you can maybe make them try and play some catch-up rugby, they might struggle a bit, but that same case can maybe be made for Ireland as well. If you put them under pressure and get a hit on the scoreboard, do they have variations in their game plan to be able to open the game up and try and come from behind and be expansive? I'm not so sure. But defensively, teams that win World Cups are usually the best defensive team. If you don't concede the tries, then you don't have to score that many yourselves. And they've always had great goal kickers, so they do enough to keep the scoreboard ticking over. They get down. Last week in the match we saw against Ireland, they had two opportunities in the first sort of 15 minutes, and they scored the tries. They converted their points. They were clinical. They scored when they had to. They keep the scoreboard ticking, and they're tough to score against. And that's the hallmarks of a champion team.
Talking of their opponents last weekend, Ireland, they sort of came into the tournament with a lot of people saying, is this the best team in the world at the moment? Are they going to be starting the World Cup as a favourite? They certainly won't be now after their performances in the Six Nations, that's for sure. Have they been found out a little, do you think, in terms of the way they play? And are they too reliant on somebody like Johnny Sexton, who had an appalling game against Wales?
I mean, their two star players is the access between Conor Murray and Johnny Sexton, and those two players seem to be off their game a bit. They didn't seem to perform to their maximum ability. And when your two playmakers are struggling, then the rest of the team showed that. Maybe they've been found out a little. Maybe they've just, they had a wonderful autumn, defeated the All Blacks. They were arguably, and stand out, that they were the second best team in the world, the best team in Europe. But the Six Nations has shown them to be a bit more fallible, really. So, question marks have been asked. Have they got the depth? A couple of injuries to key players. Their vaunted forward pack was the question mark. You know, the last couple of times I've played Wales, apart from last weekend, their forward pack has just beaten the Welsh up and dominated. They couldn't do that last week. So Wales really held their own. So, yeah, maybe they've come back down to earth, which might not be a bad thing. Better a bit of a kick in the backside now, a bit of a reality check now, four or five months before the World Cup. So it does highlight some areas for them to go work on. What you don't want to do is go into World Cup thinking you're infallible and your game's way up here, up top, and the first tough game you get in the knockout phases, you get blown away. So maybe it's a good thing for them. Same thing with England. England have improved from last year's championship. Funny old final game against Scotland. I don't know what to make
good
of that
game,
still.
Good game, though, to wrap the tournament
great
up.
Great game to thing, and you actually feel sorry for the Scottish. They should have won it.
Yeah.
Amazing comeback there, the biggest ever comeback in Six Nations history, in Test match rugby history, probably. And then they just couldn't quite hold it on at the end there. But shows England's bench depth, bringing players off the bench and be able to make a difference. George Ford came on and scored the winning try. Owen Farrell, again,
equalizing
key man
try.
For England.
Equalising try.
But Owen Farrell, on the other hand, was showing up. His game was showing up. Lack of discipline. England still have, I think, issues around the captaincy and the leadership of the team. When things are going badly, who's the key guy? Who's the guy that holds their hand up and say, follow me? Owen Farrell's been susceptible when he's been under pressure in previous matches. He slips on the old shoulder charge. Hasn't gone away. It keeps rearing up, doesn't it? And he's been lucky a number of times now not to get yellow or even red cards in matches. And you can't have that discipline. from your number 10, he is the key guy, and he hasn't played that well at key times. So he's, again, another question mark over Owen Farrell, a bit the same over Johnny Sexton. But if you're a Welshman, you're pretty happy at the moment, and you're pretty happy looking ahead to the Rugby World Cup in Japan.
Listen to the Grill, broadcasting live from Brest, where the game is always on. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we turn our attention ahead of IPL 2019.
Oh, it's a fabulous goal!
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, with more sport, the latest headlines, and top debate on Dubai Eye 103.8.
So IPL 12 gets underway in the next half an hour. We're going to have plenty of chat about IPL 12 with our cricket correspondent, Mr. Mark Archer, and a man who actually played at IPL on more than one occasion. Mr. Owe Shah is live with us here. Before we do that, though, good game to look forward to this evening with reigning champions Chennai Super Kings taking on the Royal Challengers Bangalore in the opening game of this year's IPL. So, can the Chennai Super Kings do back-to-back? Can they defend their trophy? Let's have a little look at the team that they've put together.
The Chennai Super Kings, reigning champions of the IPL, set to defend their title in 2019. Does that squad still have the strengths that it did last season? Are there any apparent weaknesses? The X-factor players to watch out for? And, of course, Sanjay Manjrekar and Brad Hodge will both pick their ideal 11s. And who should bet against Chennai and see where they'll finish? Let's get this conversation rolling by first having a look at their squad. And MS Dhoni, we know, likes a sense of familiarity, players that he's seen before. He's seen a lot of Murali Vijay. Ambati Raidu had a sensational IPL 2018. Suresh Raina's the Don Bradman of the IPL with the sort of numbers that he's had. Faf du Plessis was big for them in the playoffs. Shane Watson's coming from a rich win of form in the PSL. They got a couple of Indian reserve batsmen too. Sam Billings won them a game of his own bat last time. MS Dhoni will, of course, lead this side. And you look at the all-rounders, Bravo, who's now focusing on 2020 cricket. Mitchell Santner was retained in spite of being ruled out last season with injury. David Willey, the left-arm seamer, can also smack it around a bit. And Kedar Jadhav, Ravindra Jadeja, the established Indian all-rounders. More bowling options in addition to David Willey would be the likes of Lungi Ngidi, who had his share of contributions too. Shardul Thakur and Deepak Chahar, along with Mohit Sharma this season, could carry the mantle for India seamers. Asif also had a few games as towards the end of last season, and it'll be between Harbhajan Singh and Karan Sharma for the Indian spinner. Imran Tahir also an option if you want to go for an overseas spinner. Right, Sanjay. This team, I didn't give it a chance last season. I don't know. I don't think you did either. But we are all standing corrected. And are we still looking at a team that's capable of winning the IPL twice in a row?
Yeah, and the reason why we didn't believe that CSK would win is that they seem to have just gone with their tried and tested players. And you're worried that, you know, because all of them are past their prime.
Yes.
I mean, they picked Harbhajan Singh, you know, for God's sake. So you can see a lot of emotions and attachment coming into play. But I tell you what, if it was not Mahendra Singh Dhoni leading that CSK team with the kind of players that they had, I don't think they would have won the IPL. He managed to use them well. Use of Shardul Thakur and Chahar also tells you about Dhoni being the one man who made it possible. They didn't have a champion team to begin with. And this year, nothing's changed much. And the thing about aging players is they might look brilliant one year, but because they're not playing as much international cricket, age not on their side, they could just fall off the next season. So we'll have to see what happens.
What are your expectations from Chennai, Hoji, this year?
Yeah, I totally agree with Sanjay, actually. I mean, from what I know in T20 cricket, it's more experience that gets the job done in terms of inexperience. So, yeah, I think Dhoni and his crew have put together a pretty good squad last year, but it's what's going to happen this year. I thought we were going to see a lot of vulnerability in the field. They're actually quite good in the field. I mean, they weren't outstanding, but they got the job done. There's some flexibility in that unit. They've got a deep batting unit, and it's more so the leadership of Dhoni which gets the best out of this unit. He's probably the only one that can. Let's wait and see. It's all about how they roll into this season, whether they can get off to a good start or not and keep the momentum through to the finals.
Yeah, nobody better than you, Brad Hodge, to talk about the value of experienced players in 2020 cricket. Are you picking any of these slightly seasoned players in your X factors for this team?
Well, I have. I've gone for the evergreen Shane Watson, only on the fact that look, I saw him smack him around a little bit in the Big Bash, and his PSL form has been pretty good. So, he seems to be getting better with age, like a fantastic dark red wine, Shane Watson. So he was brilliant last year, got the job done in the final, and I think it'll do the same again this year.
Yeah, he's coming off a stellar run in the PSL, leading run scorer this year. Have you gone for a Watson as well? Have you gone for other established season names that MS Dhoni likes to have in his team?
See, that's the danger with somebody like a Shane Watson. I mean, he played a terrific innings in the finals as well. I think he was man of the match there and has had a great recent form. But who knows, IPL, aging player and not playing enough. So, difficult one for me to bet on. So, I've gone for somebody who's in his prime, is Faf du Plessis. Because he's been getting runs and sometimes playing a lone hand for South Africa. So Faf du Plessis is my X factor. He proved to be the X factor in the playoffs for CSK. And you know what I've done? I've given experience also, a lot of credit, because it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
If it works, it works beautifully. Sometimes it can play against you. So what's their X factor? The experience in a pressure situation, which can also, destroy them on a given night. And Faf.
Now, in spite of Faf's certainly his impactful innings in the playoffs, there would be questions whether he would find place in your ideal 11. So Sanjay will obviously put him in his playing 11 for CSK. What does that mean for Ambati Raidu, who got most of his runs batting at the top of the order? It probably means, Sanjay, that you'll see someone like Raidu come in at either 3 or 4 with Suresh Raina, who likes to make that number 3 position his own. Kedar Jadhav was ruled out early with injury last season. You've retained him ahead of Ravindra Jadeja, who you don't have any room for. There is Shardul Thakur in that team too, and Lungi Ngidi as the overseas seamer.
Yeah, I think when I'm looking at the playing 11, Ambati Raidu would be my number 3. Suresh Raina was a bit blow cold last season. Faf du Plessis has to open. Shane Watson has to open. And then you've got Kedar Jadhav, Dwayne Bravo, Dhoni being the floater in this side. I've got Lungi Ngidi because I thought he was really brilliant last season, whatever matches he played, and Dhoni loves him. And there was a toss-up between Imran Tahir and Karan Sharma for that wrist spinner's position that every team must have. I've gone for Karan Sharma. I've always liked Karan Sharma. If there's a pitch that's suitable to him, I don't think there's a big enough difference between him and Imran Tahir. Plus, foreign player Imran Tahir rather have somebody else.
Yeah, they could be using Imran Tahir and then have to compromise on perhaps a Faf du Plessis at the top, fill that slot with an Indian player. What does Brad Hodges' ideal CSK 11 look like? Just have a quick look. And we'll see room for Faf du Plessis there too. But I think if that's anything to go by, Hodgie, you want Raidu to keep at that position where he got those runs last season. Use Faf in the top or middle order. Jadeja is in your team, so you've found room for India's left-arm spinning all-rounder. And you've got Deepak Chahar, so no Shardul Thakur, and Ngidi ahead of David Willey. Thoughts, Hodgie?
Yeah, well, I just think that it's probably the MSD factor which will back Jadu in, especially. I think he's had a pretty good one-day series for India just recently. So that form might carry him in. Faf du Plessis was an interesting one where, you could put him at the top, but I thought Raidu, who might be really hungry after his one-day omission, put him at the top. I think he might have a stellar IPL. So Faf is in great touch as well, and I think he can be flexible in the middle. Maybe a fraction vulnerable against spin, but I think that he's sort of worked on his game there and has got a hold of it. But all in all, they're a pretty flexible side under the banner of MSD. So I want to see something out of Dwayne Bravo as well. So if he can turn it on, they're a dangerous side. If not, they may struggle.
Just a quick point emerging from what Brad said. Made a good point about Ambati Raidu. But there's also going to be another maybe effect of the World Cup coming and people who are on the fringe and not yet confirmed of their place in that side. Ambati Raidu, for example, I'm sure is playing the IPL and thinking the selectors are still watching. They have claimed or they've gone record saying IPL performances do not matter. But if Ambati Raidu has a great IPL, I think it just sort of makes his place more secure. So that might actually be added pressure on Ambati Raidu.
Okay, so could work either ways. Where do you see this team finishing? You still think they're good enough for the top four?
Can I say no?
Of course you can.
Yeah, just the Dhoni factor. When you say no and suddenly I find my face on Instagram and what's that? Dhoni fan club saying that CSK, Sanjay Manjari.
So let's put it this way. You would be surprised if CSK made the top four?
No, I think eventually you've got to say that they will make the four. But as I said, double-edged sword with experience.
All right. Hodgie, thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I think they'll just sneak in. I think between them and Delhi Capitals to round out that fourth or fifth position. So once they get in there, it's a 50-50 contest. So experience may pay off. So if they do sneak in, watch out, competition.
Very well. Watch out then for the Chennai Super Kings, who of course kickstart this year's IPL and also have the luxury of having the final at their home ground.
So plenty of food for thought there. Let's get the thoughts of the boys as we delve into all things IPL. Oh, Shah has been there, done that. He's played at the IPL on several occasions. How many seasons over there?
Five seasons.
So you know the inner workings of this extraordinary tour. Did you know? Well, you know that first season that you went over there. Did you know that this was a different kettle of fish? This was a little bit special. This is something that was going to not just to make a name for itself over in India, but globally.
Well, yeah. I mean, when your name goes up in the auction and someone says, $270,000, you're thinking, geez, this is unheard of. And that's probably the biggest thing about the IPL. I know it's very well paid, but they were the first one to, you know, bring in the auction.
Yeah.
And that's never been done in cricket, and which really sort of, you know, I don't care which player it is, when your name goes up, you're nervous. You want to know what you're worth. You want to know how good you are. And that's, you know, we're all sort of, all international cricketers want to be tested at the top, and you all of a sudden think, oh wow, this competition has got the top cricketers in the world playing this T20 competition, and I'm going to go out there and perform in front of packed houses, deafening noise. I mean, the noise is ridiculous. And yes, in an environment that you actually don't really experience anywhere else in the world.
I just got a question for you. It's always bamboozled me a bit about the auction. So, and the player amounts, and obviously I understand the process. A player comes on the board, Oa Shah, all the 10 teams in the IPL, or 12 teams there, bidding for you with their little panels, and the numbers change. Now, when they bid for a player and the winning bids, say it gets up to $1 million, I think some players have gone for $1 million, is that the player's salary, or that's just the amount that they've bid to get the player? Then they have to negotiate a salary deal with them. Just tell me how. Just talk us through the mechanism of how it works.
That's your salary, all right. You go for $1 million. You're getting $1 million, but the thing
it's pro rata though.
That's pro rata. So
you have to play. I mean, I think it's like 12 or 16 matches in the.
Yeah. So if you're say for example, Archie, you go for $1 million.
A bit more than that, probably around 1.5.
Yeah.
1.5 to 2 for me.
1.5. All right. But just for argument's sake, let's keep it $1 million. And they're what, I think 18 games, something like that.
Yeah, say it's 18 matches.
Also, let's keep it simple. You got 10 games.
10 matches.
You're going to get 100 grand every game as long as you're in the playing 11.
So if you're not playing.
So pro rata, if you play 10 games, you go for $1 million, you're getting $1 million, right? If you don't play a game, you will get 80% of that 100 grand. So you'll get,
that's not bad.
Yeah, that's not bad. So you'll get 80,000.
So I could be the drinks boy.
Yeah.
And still make a lot of money.
And still taking home 80 grand for that night of cricket.
It's pretty good.
Running on drinks.
It's a great deal.
So I'm
assuming you're not paying for anything while you're there, are you? I mean,
no.
You're being coaches or jets around? Is it?
No. So you fly. Yeah, you fly.
Flying everywhere.
Yeah, you're flying. So basically you get treated like an international cricketer. I mean, international teams now, you literally pack your bags and put it outside your hotel room. Yeah. And someone will take it away. It'll find itself in the hole in the plane. And then it'll magically appear outside your door at the next hotel room.
Okay.
Once you've checked in, someone will knock, say, hey, here's your suitcase. And then you carry on staying there for 2-3 days. And you do the same again. You pack it, leave it outside your room. I mean, that's the level of, you know, sort of care that's provided for all the international cricketers and in the IPL.
I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it, Arch, when you look at the model of IPL, and I remember you and I sort of, you know, chatting about it on that first year, 11 years ago, on the sports show and talking
we
about...
We raised our eyebrows, didn't we?
Raised our eyebrows.
We wrote it off.
I think we thought it might have been a bit of flash in the pan, it wouldn't last, etc.
And a lot of good players weren't playing.
Yes.
I think the best Australian players weren't there, and it was a bit of a mixture of different nationalities weren't... None of the English players were there in the first season, I think. Ace, were
no,
they?
No, not in the first one, no.
They didn't really get... And to be fair, a lot of England players have... only until the last couple of seasons have really had the opportunity to play it.
Yeah.
For many years, the ECB, those English cricketers under ECB contracts weren't allowed to go and play. So it wasn't. It was still a domestic tournament, but still some countries chose to sort of really engage with it make it part of, or some countries didn't as well. And we haven't seen a lot of Pakistani players playing it for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
So some of the best players weren't there, but at the same time, we sort of IPL. We'll see how it goes, Tom, didn't we?
Yeah, I mean, Pakistani players have only played the first season. And, I mean, they did well. Afridi did really well. Mohammad Asif, a blast from the past, he did really well for Delhi. But then, obviously, after that, like you mentioned, political reasons, Pakistan haven't been able to play. And, I mean, they've come up with their own version of PSL, Pakistan Super League, which has been obviously been here in Dubai and in Pakistan. Now you see a lot more English players involved actively in the IPL, which is really good. And even down to the fact that some of the commentators, Michael Vaughan's gone over there and commentated, Kevin Peterson's gone over there and commentated. So that's, you know, I think there's a good involvement of English.
But it's also spawned franchise cricket, isn't it? Because, I mean, show me a cricket country the world over worth its weight in gold, or somebody who has aspirations to play cricket at the top level who doesn't have a franchise competition, and that all comes from the IPL.
Yeah, no, exactly right. And from that came the Big Bash League, and now we've seen recently the PSL here. England have sort of taken a while to really try and figure it out. They've kind of changed. They tried to, and this is where T20 cricket actually originated in the UK, but they haven't quite got it yet. And they've got a new competition, the 100, coming up in a season or two. So they've sort of brushed around it because they still have 18 counties, and the competition doesn't really work to play for 18 counties playing. They haven't quite figured out to combine the counties. Counties don't want to join together. It's historical. But we've seen the Big Bash. And for you, Oasis, it provided almost a second career. Is it fair to say that you had your great career playing county cricket, you then played a lot of cricket for England, and then you had the second career playing franchise cricket? Many seasons in the Big Bash League, down with Hobart, won championships down there, IPL for 5 seasons, and other franchises as well. I don't know if you played the Caribbean Premier League. Was that one? Yeah, Caribbean Premier League. Done them all.
I've done them all. I played Bangladesh as well. Now, look, you're dead right. I think I was about 31. I sort of found myself out of the England team. I got released from Middlesex and I joined Essex. And I just looked at myself and thought, you know what? I'm going to try really hard to get back into the England team. But at the same time, I also thought this 2020 thing stuff is picking up. I need to really reinvent myself a little bit. I mean, I did play a few shots anyway, but I really sort of went to town in terms of reinventing myself as a batsman and really try and nail the T20. And I was really fortunate enough. My real break came for Hobart Hurricanes. I sort of managed to get a deal there. Michael Duvenuto was the one who sort of got me down there. And I had a really, really good summer playing for Hobart. I was the third highest run scorer. And from the back of that, I mean, I got IPL, I got South Africa, I got Caribbean, I got all these other leagues, which I'm really, really happy. So, yeah, it's definitely a second career, and I'm really happy that I got an opportunity to play in the IPL.
Just working through your teams, franchises in the IPL, and correct me if I'm wrong on these ones. So, Kolkata Knight Riders for a couple of seasons, is that right?
Just the one season. 1 year at Delhi.
Delhi Daredevils.
Then Kochi Tuskers.
The Kochi Tuskers? What's happened to the Kochi Tuskers?
Well, they decided to come in for one summer and then not pay the next year.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah, they got kicked out.
And then 2 years
at Rajasthan Royals, yeah. Which was probably my best years, because actually Rajasthan Royals actually gave me an opportunity to go and play regular cricket. Rahul Dravid was captain. I got backed by the franchise, and absolutely loved it.
One thing, you're no stranger to having played with other international stars. We have we've got the overseas player format back in the UK, but obviously that's quite limited with how many overseas players you can play. Towards the back end of your career, you would have had more relationship with the sort of Kolkata players coming in as well. You've played for the MCC, obviously, and other touring sides with other internationals. But did franchise cricket, did IPL change the way that you played with other nationalities and learned from them?
Oh, it was brilliant. I mean, and going back to Hobart again, I turned up in Hobart, and guess who was the first person to greet me? Ricky Ponting. I was sitting at breakfast in my first morning there before our first game, and Ricky comes over and says, mate, can I come and sit next to you? And starts talking like he's my best mate.
Did you go, g'day, punter?
Yeah, g'day, mate. Yeah. It was unbelievable. I was sort of pinching myself thinking, this is the great man. You know, I mean, I know I played against him for England and stuff, and I mean, I admired his batting, but he was actually just sitting next to me and we were just talking like, you know, and he was really interested in where's my career going, what are you doing with yourself, da, 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 da. And I'm, you know, things like that, I was shocked. Like, he took an interest in me. And it was brilliant.
In the IPL as well, you must have shared dressing room with players you may have played against in your international career, but here you are playing, travelling, you know, maybe not rooming, but breakfast.
Oh, everything.
You know, partying, because I know the IPL have a bit of a party scene as well. I mean, you just, for a month or 6 weeks, you're just with guys that you never would have imagined growing up that you're thinking.
Well, yeah, I mean, I used to, my first year at Calcutta Knight Riders, when you travel in buses, you'll generally have your own spot. You know, but you always generally go and sit. I would go and sit next to Wasim Akram. He was a bowling coach there. And I would just, you know, try and tap into his knowledge. Then my time at Rajasthan Royals, Rahul Dravid, I always made a point I was going to go and sit next to him and just talk batting or even talk to him about why was he thinking in certain situations, you know, in strategies. What were you thinking, Rahul? Why did you do this? Why did you do that? Bit of a badger, really, I was. But I wanted to learn how and why did he do certain things and how did he cope with pressure and all that sort of stuff. I was just loved it. I was just soaking it up.
So what you're saying is you're the guy that when you get on the coach, they'll put the headphones on.
Yeah.
got the iPads out, yeah. Put the headphones on, and notice the next to me always.
And then you realise he hasn't got the bloody headphone plugged in.
Humming away to themselves. Just a quick one on that, though, for both of you, because, I mean, what it has done, as you quite rightly say, is thrown together different nationalities. But then I suppose it also throws up connection where that we all know that certain players get on with certain players, and then there are those that you don't get on with during your playing career, especially from different nationalities, when there's a lot made about competition on and off the field. I know the old adage goes that, you know, you play hard on the field and then your mates off the field afterwards, etc. But we have seen bad-tempered series recently. India-Australia, great example of that one. England-Australia in years gone by, a couple of that you've probably played in as well. Has that helped to bridge those gaps, do you think, Arch? Or does it take away from an element of that competitiveness that you might find in an Ashes or another series?
No, I think it definitely has. Now you've got some fierce rivalries between individual players, you know, bowlers versus batsmen type things. You know, there's always been sledging's been part of cricket for a long, long time. But then some of those players who had these probably great rivalries between nationalities playing international cricket share a dressing room.
That's right.
And they probably just have forced to get on and get on with it, and, you know, probably realise that he's actually probably a good bloke. He's probably similar to yourself, and you can probably got more in common than you thought, and you do it. What about you, Ace? Did you sort of have any of those ongoing rivalries? You weren't the most vocal of sort of players, were you, in terms of having a hard time? But I'm sure some bowlers had a good go at you in your career, and you probably ended up sharing a dressing room with them in the IPL.
Yeah, I mean, I used to always copy from the great Shane Warne. God, he didn't stop every time I batted. I wasn't lucky enough to share a dressing room with him. But again, going back to Ricky Ponting, you know, when you play against him and you think, you know, obviously he was the Australian captain, he doesn't give you anything. He was always staring at you in the field when you're batting. But then when I sort of sat next to him and I thought, wow, what a lovely guy. Yeah. Glenn McGrath played for Middlesex for 2 months. And I actually, after the first week of knowing Glenn, and I said, Glenn, you're actually a nice guy. Why are you such a, you know what, on the pitch? You know, why do you carry on like it? Whatever. And he just said, you know, and he just laughed and actually quite enjoyed Glenn's company. He's a lovely guy. And then when we played and because of that friendship, when we were at Delhi together, and I just kept going. I used to sometimes go sit next to him on the bus and say, old fella, you're past it. Come on, give it up now. Come on, give it up now. And, you know, we just have banter and stuff like that. So, I definitely do believe that franchise cricket does help. Bring people together. But I tell you what, one rivalry I would love to have seen, or I'd like to see those two in the same team, Kirtley Ambrose and Steve Waugh. I would have loved to see those two play in the same team. That would have been quite funny.
T20 came a little late for both of those two, didn't it? Unfortunately for us.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.